I'm super excited to be able to share with you guys tonight the fact that Scott is going through the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah has an amazing place in my heart. 10 years ago, I was going off to boot camp, and I was like, you know, I've grown up in the church, and I want to start reading the Bible for myself. And I opened it up, and the first book I tried to tackle was the book of Jeremiah. And I hated it. No, I did not get anything out of it. I read it and I was like, this guy is a whining bummer and I don't even know what he's talking about. And I just like, I closed it and I'm like, never again. I'm sticking to the New Testament and I'm not going down there anymore. And so for years I didn't touch it. And then all of a sudden, and I'll explain this later, but all of a sudden my relationship with God started getting a lot better, because it wasn't very good when I was 18. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna reread Jeremiah. So I reread it, and to this day, it's my favorite book in the entire Bible. It's an amazing, amazing book. It's incredible. For those of you guys who have read it, you know what I'm talking about. But the first thing that I wanted to share with you in that is that the Bible was written in a very different way than what most of us are used to. In America, in our culture, we're used to, we have a very knowledge-based culture, meaning that we try to educate ourselves. When we go to school, the teacher tells you answers. They teach you how to do things. They don't teach you how to think, though. They teach you how, they do the thinking for you, and they tell you what the answer is. That's why you're going to forget most of what you learned in high school, like a year later. You know, you're not really going to remember it, because we have, like I said, we have an education-based culture. The Bible was written in a wisdom-based culture. And in a wisdom-based culture, you didn't give someone the answers. You gave them the tools to figure it out for themselves. Right? And that's what the Bible is. The Bible isn't a book of just answers. The Bible is a book of tools that will lead you to the answers. I mean, think for a second about how Jesus taught. It must have been infuriating for people hanging around him. You know, people would ask him a very simple question. He would go off about farmers or something like that. They'd be like, hey, Jesus, you know, tell my brother to give me his inheritance. He's like, let me tell you the story of a dude who had a farm. And they're like, what? You know, like, can you just say yes or no? And he's like, no, right? Because if you just give someone the answer and they never work for it, they won't understand what they know and they won't retain what they know, right? The Bible is meant to be a thinking book. You're supposed to read it and think about it, meditate on it, and grow in your knowledge of it. I didn't understand that when I read it 10 years ago. So when I read Jeremiah, I was like, this is boring, and I closed it. What I didn't realize is that there was treasures in the book that you needed to dig for, and I was too lazy to do the digging. Right? But when you dig for them, they're quite beautiful. Right? So the main difference between me when I read it again and me when I read it when I was 18, it had everything to do with my love for God. My love for God had intensified over that period of time, to the point where I wanted to dig for the treasures of God. When I was 18, my love for God was so weak that I didn't have the will to dig for the answers. I didn't really want to pursue God with everything that I was. So I'm going to go through with you guys. I'm going to kind of take you through the entire book. I'm going to pick out some of my favorite passages from it. And I'm just going to talk to you guys about how this book has impacted me, how it's blessed me and encouraged me throughout my life. The first thing that I want to point out for you guys is Jeremiah 1, verse 4. Let me read it for you. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you, ordained you a prophet to the nations. Right. This passage impacted me when I read it. Because when you read through the book of Jeremiah, you know, spoiler for you guys, I'm sorry, I'm going to be spoiling the book of Jeremiah for you guys tonight, but, you know, when you go through the book of Jeremiah, what you realize is that Jeremiah's story is ultimately a tragic one. Jeremiah had a lot of high hopes. He believed that he was going to lead the people of Israel into a great restoration and revival towards the living God. During his time, the people had drifted away from the Lord and they were worshiping idols. And God had given Jeremiah a very heavy prophetic ministry. He said, you're going to talk to the people about what their actions are going to cost them. They're going to cost them their land and their relationship with me. They're going to go into captivity. It's going to be terrible. And Jeremiah thought, man, surely if I start talking to the people about this coming judgment, they're going to repent and it's going to be amazing. There's going to be this grand revival. But as you go through it, you realize that the people of Israel never listened to Jeremiah. They try to kill him repetitively throughout the entire book. He's rejected by almost everybody. And even after the people go into captivity and everything that Jeremiah prophesied about comes to pass, they still don't listen to him. There's a moment at the end of the book where the people of Israel are freaked out because an assassination happened in the land of Israel, and they're like, oh my gosh, the Babylonians are going to come, they're going to kill us. And Jeremiah asks God, what should we do? And God says, tell them to stay put. If they stay put, everything will be fine. If they go to Egypt, you're all going to die. But God then says to him, he's like, but they're not going to listen to you, just so you know. So Jeremiah goes to him and he's like, hey guys, this is what God told me. But he's like, but I know you guys are not going to listen to me, but I just wanted to tell you. And they're like, cool. And they drag him off to Egypt and he dies. That's the end of the book. It's the whole book, you know, and it's so tragic. You're like, how could a book like this end like this? But what I got from this verse is that God had planned the life of Jeremiah since before he was born. A lot of times when I looked at my life, I saw a tragedy. I shouldn't have, but I did. I saw a tragedy because I wasn't the way I wanted to be. I grew up in a household with some older siblings who were far more successful than I am in a lot of ways. You know, they were just better at school. They were better at athletics. They were better at a lot of things, and I never excelled. It wasn't that I was no good. It's just that compared to them, I wasn't very good. And these weird inferiority complexes started cropping up in my life, where I just had this sensation that there was something inherently wrong with me and that everybody else was more successful than me and that my life was kind of worthless. By the time I was around 13 years old, I had become an atheist. I'd left my faith with God, and I started having suicidal thoughts. I just was not living a very good life. My life was never really turning around. And even after I gave my life back to God, I always had this picture of God that he was really upset with the way that I turned out, that he's like, he was kind of bummed. He's like, man, I kind of wanted you to be this way, but man, I guess I got to make do with what I got. You know, I had this like picture of God that he just was never really proud of me and what I was and what I was doing. And when I read Jeremiah 1 verse 4, and as I read it even to this day, it gives me assurance that God has planned my path, right? That I'm not a mistake, to put it that way. That the way I am, and the things that are a part of my life and a part of my personality and identity, those things were intended by God. What a crucial thing for all of us to understand. If you're constantly fighting who you are, you can never become what God intends you to be. Right? If you are ashamed of who you are and you're constantly fighting your identity the way that God made you, you will never progress in the way that God intends for you to progress. It only comes when you accept the way that God has created you. Yes, you have to understand that there are parts of you that have been corrupted by sin and you're going the wrong way. But did you know everything that's wrong with you is just the good parts that God placed on you flipped on their head? That's it. Right? Everything that's sinful about me, it's just something, it's a good quality that God instilled in me that's been perverted by my sinful nature. Right? There's nothing inherently wrong with it. It's just been perverted. And I had to understand that. Jeremiah helped me understand this truth in a very, very beautiful way. And I hope you guys understand it as well, right? That you're not spending your life fighting the way that God designed you. The big and major component of my life that I've always fought and I've always been against, I've talked to you guys about it before, has been my depression. I've always struggled with depression since I was a little kid. And I've always seen it as an emotional weakness, and I've tried to shut it out and ignore it. Jeremiah is actually, if you read his book, he was a very depressed guy. They call him the weeping prophet, and he's got some gems in this book, some stuff that I'm like, that's awesome, you know, like, I'll read you one of them later, but one of my favorite ones is he says, oh, that my head were made out of waters, and I can never cease from crying, and I'm like, man, I've been there, that's cool, you know, like, Jeremiah gets me, and God says, I designed him like that. That's radical. That's really, really cool that God does that. The next thing I want you guys to get from Jeremiah is in Jeremiah 2, verse 2 through 3. God says, go and cry in the hearing of Jerusalem, saying, thus says the Lord, I remember you, the kindness of your youth and the love of your betrothal, that you went after me in the wilderness in a land not sown. Israel was holiness to the Lord, the first fruits of his increase. All that devour him will offend. Disaster will come upon them, says the Lord. Now, this is really cool. I love this section. God is speaking to the children of Israel, and he's trying to get them to remember their zeal for him when they first came into a relationship with him. And he says, and the picture he's painting is really cool. It's like that of a newlywed couple, Right? He's like, you remember when we were in the wilderness, you know, when we didn't have anything? You know, it's kind of like when a couple first gets married and they're in like a one-bedroom apartment with nothing. And they're like, but they have each other and that's enough. That's what God's saying. He's like, dude, we were in the desert. We didn't have anything, but we had each other and that was enough. And you loved me and there was beauty there. And then anyone who would even look at you funky, man, I would destroy them. And that's why he says disaster will come upon them. I like that part where God's like he's like a jealous husband. He's a protective husband. It's really, really cool. And when I read that passage, a couple things just like sprung out to me. The first thing that sprung out to me was, have I forgotten the zeal of my youth? Meaning, when I first gave my life to God, I was on fire for him. Man, I was zealous for God. I was going after him with everything. But then over the years, something kind of happens to you, right? You start to fade. Your passion for God begins to kind of go away. And it's like this not just in your relationship with God. It's like this everywhere, right? You get in a new job or a new career. The second you start learning this new career, it's very exciting and passionate and awesome. But over time, it gets old. Right, you get in a new relationship, it's very fiery and passionate, it's all new and it's all fresh, but then over time it starts to fade. And I didn't understand why that was happening to me. But this passage, I think, gives us a lot of insight as to why it happens. There's a counselor, a marriage counselor named Esther Perel, and she said this: if we think of a verb that goes with passion, it's desire. And if we think of a verb that goes with non-passion, it would be having. What she's saying is very insightful. What she's saying essentially is that the reason why passion is so hot when you first get involved with something is because desire feeds passion. And when you have something, there's nothing left to desire, and so passion fades. Right? But when I read this passage, it showed me how wrong I was in pursuing God in the way that I was pursuing him. Everybody here knows, if you've been in any long-term relationship, is that, yeah, you'll never get back the novelty in the beginning of a relationship that you had, but there's something far better about gaining insight and understanding and depth to a relationship than there is in just gaining a relationship. Meaning this, it's like, yeah, when I first started hanging out with my wife, it was all new and fresh. I didn't know anything about her, and it was very exciting, but I didn't know anything about her, right? When people came up to me, they're like, hey, what do you like about Emma? I'm like, I don't know, she's awesome. She's great, you know? And they're like, well, what about her is great? I'm like, she's great, you know? She's just awesome. I don't know, she's just awesome. I had no depth, I had no sustenance to my passion. You guys get that? It was just shallow. It was just a shallow excitement that comes and goes, right? But now, as we've been together, I mean, we dated for 2 years, we've been married for 3, so we've been together for 5 years. It's like now I could see that as our relationship deepens and the roots go down deeper and deeper, and the more I know her and the more I understand her, the more I realize I'll never fully understand her. And that's exciting. That's a good thing, you know? Like, if you think that you're just going to understand something, then it's boring, you know? Then you're just like, oh, I already know everything about you. You know, but our relationship is constantly growing and changing in new and cool ways, right? It's far more exciting to be in this stage of my marriage than it was when I first met Emma. Right? Because that's how relationships work. The reason why my passion had died for God, and this is so tragic for people who grow up in the church usually, is because we say this fatal phrase, I've heard it. Right? You go into church and you hear a sermon, you're like, oh, I've heard that. You know, I already know that. And your passion and your zeal starts to die slowly because you think that everything that you could have in a relationship with God has already been had. If you think that all your best times with God are in the past, of course your passion's going to go nowhere. Of course it's going to dry up. But if you understand that the zeal that you had in the beginning of your walk with God was incredibly shallow, and a depth of relationship with God is way better, then you will grow in your relationship with God. I didn't get that. And so this passage helps me see that. The second thing, and probably the more important thing that you get out of this passage, is the view that God has towards his people who are rebelling against him. It's present in this passage, but it's illuminated a little bit more in Jeremiah 31, verse 3 through 4. The Lord appeared of old to me, saying, yes, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness I have drawn you. Again I will build you, and you shall be rebuilt. O virgin of Israel, you shall again be adorned with your tambourines, and you shall go forth in the dances of those who rejoice. I love this passage, man. It's so cool. Because one of the reasons why my relationship with God was so difficult is, I already told you guys, I viewed him as a disappointed father figure, someone who never really looked at me with joy or gladness. I love this passage because it shows that that's not true. My view of God had been tainted by my understanding of the world. Meaning, I had projected onto God the negative aspects of my relationships on this earth. And I had assumed things about him that were untrue. Right? One of the reasons why I left God when I was 13 years old is because when I was around 13 years old, I started viewing pornography. And I was incredibly ashamed by that because I knew how wrong it was. And I walked away from God because I thought, I can never please God with this life that I'm living, so I might as well leave him. Right? I'll never be able to have an intimacy with God because all I can have with God is condemnation. That's how I honestly felt with him. And even when I was trying to come back into a relationship with God, I always felt that God was kind of on the outskirts. He was waiting for me in heaven. And he's like, once you make it, Peter, then we can have a relationship, right? But you got to really work, man. You got to get rid of all this sin in your life, and you got to be better, and you got to do better, and you got to be like everybody else. You got to be as perfect and pure as they are. And I just never felt like I could make it. When I read Jeremiah, I rejoiced because Jeremiah demonstrates the profound, amazing, intense love that God has for people who are failures, right? Who have tried to do what's right and have ultimately fallen short, which is ultimately what I am. I'm someone who has tried to do what's right and has fallen short time and time and time again. But when God speaks to Jeremiah, he's not speaking to people who are doing the right thing. He's speaking to people who are a mess. And he's telling Jeremiah, I have loved you with an everlasting love. There's no beginning to God's love for me or you. There was no moment where God fell in love with us, right? Like humans do. And if there was no moment where God fell in love with you, that means that there is never going to be a moment where he's going to fall out of love with you. Right? It's an everlasting, never-changing, all-powerful love that God has for you. And notice the promise at the end, I will build you and you shall be rebuilt. Man, I held that promise so close to my heart because I believed that God wanted to restore something that was broken in me. And these passages like this, gave me the hope to trust that God was going to fulfill it. Right? If you've backslidden, if you're in a state of your Christian walk where you've backslidden from God, if you do look back and you say the best times that I've had with the Lord are in the past, man, passages like this will become life to you. Because what God is promising you is it doesn't have to stay that way. Right? He could rebuild you. He could, in fact, make your relationship with him today better than it's ever been in the past. Right? He can restore what's been broken down, even by our own foolishness. The next passage that jumps out to me is Jeremiah 2, verse 12 through 13. Jeremiah, this is his first sermon, right? His first sermon is Pastor Jeremiah. He's trying to get people's attention, and he says, be astonished, O heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be very desolate, says the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. This passage, what it's trying to show us, what Jeremiah is trying to explain to the people, is something that is mind-blowing if you grab it and if you believe it, right? If you accept what's being said here. God's greatest offense at what the people of Israel were doing was being miserable. Let me say that again. God's greatest offense at what his people were doing was being miserable. Meaning that God is saying that I am a pleasurable God. Look at how he explains himself. He says, I am the fountain of living waters. He says, I am the source of all pleasure and satisfaction. I am the source of all joy. I am the source of all peace. I am the source of all pleasure that there ever could be in this universe. And he says, and you can come to me. You could be satisfied in me. And he says, be amazed, O heavens. Right? Cry out in terror as you see my people ignoring me, the fount of living water, and hewing for themselves broken cisterns that could hold no water. I could think of no better metaphor to explain my sin than this one. Right? when I was 13 and I stopped going after God and I started pursuing pornography, I looked at God as an obstacle to my pleasure. I was like, God, I want to live a certain way. I want to live a certain way because that's going to make me happy. And you sit up in heaven and you tell me how I should live. And that explanation, that command is what's keeping me from my greatest joy, God. Right? So I left him. I was like, I don't want there to be a God because I like what I'm doing. I'm having satisfaction in what I'm doing. There's pleasure in what I'm doing. And God tells me no. But this metaphor is so impactful. See, in the Middle East, what they would do is they don't get a whole lot of rain, much like us, but they don't have, you know, in these days, they didn't have running water. So what they would do is they would dig these wells. They were like these cisterns, these wells they would dig in the ground. And when it rained, it would collect water, and they would draw from that to get water for their households, right? It makes sense, right? But I don't know how many of you guys have actually tried to dig in the desert. But it's not fun, right? I did two deployments over in Afghanistan. We had to dig these mortar fighting pits, and these mortar fighting pits were 3 meters low, and they were like 10 meters in diameter. So it was a lot of work. And what you realize when you dig in the desert is the first like inch is easy, right? It just comes off. It's just silt. And then you hit like limestone, and you hit like concrete, and it's just like you gotta put some real elbow grease into that thing to get any amount of work done. Right? And then look at what God's saying. He's saying, you guys have a fountain. You have a fountain. You have a never-ending source of pleasure and water. And you're ignoring that to go into the desert to do back-breaking labor that's going to create a hole that every now and then is going to get filled with water. But guess what? It's broken. There's a hole in the bottom that all the water just seeps right out of. So all the pleasure that you have and all, no matter how great it is, it's going to go as fast as you got it. Right? What a great metaphor for sin. All this time I was pursuing sexual sin and I was pursuing my pleasure there, and I didn't realize that all the pleasure I got, man, the higher the high, the lower the come down. I mean, that's just the truth. Man, yeah, I got a lot of pleasure out of it, but I also got a lot of emptiness out of it too. And I got a lot of depression out of it, and I got a lot of frustration out of it. It never did for me what I thought it would. And the pleasure that I got was intermittent at best, meaning it would take time for it to even settle in for me. I went long periods of time with no pleasure whatsoever. And then, yeah, every now and then it was cool, but then it would just fade away as quickly as it came and leave me more empty than I was before. I thought God was standing in the way of my true pleasure. This passage says that my pleasure is standing in the way of true joy in God. The things that I think are going to make me happy in this world are standing in my way of what will actually make me happy in this world. And many Christians quote this passage in Matthew. It's a great passage. Jesus says, if you want to be my disciples, take up your cross and follow me. For he who loses his life for my sake will find it. But he who holds on to his life will lose it. And people read that and they're like, oh, see, you know, Jesus is saying, in order to follow him, you got to give up your pleasure. You got to live a bummed out life where you go to church and that's terrible because church is boring, and you got to read this old book and it's super boring, and you got to pray and that's boring, and you got to give up everything that's fun, and it's going to be a lame life, but man, it's worth it because God is holy, you know? And that's the picture that people painted for me. I was like, yeah, you know, that's holiness, man. You know, just giving up everything that's good and just living this life that's lame. But then you get to look down at people who aren't living the life that you're living and be like, man, I'm so much more righteous. You know, these people are having fun. Not me, man. You know, not me. You know, and that's kind of the way that we picture it, but that's not the picture that's being painted for us here. What does Jesus say? He says, pick up your cross and what? Follow me. If you try to hold on to your life, you're going to lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake, you're going to find it. Jesus doesn't call you to hand over pleasure. He calls you to lay down things that call themselves pleasure but will ultimately be things that put you in bondage. To put it another way, Jesus calls you to lay down the things that can never satisfy your soul so that you might gain him who actually can. It's a pretty good trade-off. But you have to have faith. See, the reason why I didn't have faith to do that is because I never pictured God as a pleasurable God. I never did. Right? I never pictured the idea of going after God as being a pleasurable thing, as a satisfying thing, as an enjoyable thing. Because I had a weird view of God. I had this view of God that he was, like I said, a bummer in the sky, who was just shaking his finger at me and constantly incensed at what I was doing. I never had a picture of God as him being enjoyable, as being pleasurable, as being beautiful. And there's so many passages I could read for you guys on that, but my favorite one is Psalm 16, verse 11. In Psalm 16, verse 11, God is speaking. He says, "At your right hand are pleasures forevermore, and in your presence is the fullness of joy." Right? I read that passage and I was like, man, could I have been wrong all my life? Could I have been wrong all my life and thinking that God is something that he's actually not? And believing that God isn't pleasurable when he really is? And I read this passage and I thought, man, like, what if it's true? What if it is better? What if it's more pleasurable to walk away from pornography than it is to walk towards it? And that was the first time in my life I started seeing actual victory. That was the first time in my life where I just felt free. Because I was laboring under this weight all the time where I was like, man, I got to go against my pleasure and this is going to be terrible, but I have to do it. And so all the time, even when I wasn't going after sexual morality, it was always on my mind. I was always in bondage to it because I was always thinking about it every day. When I read this, I was like, I don't have to think about it anymore. I have something better. God is better than what I have been pursuing. He's greater. He's more enjoyable. And if you guys have never pursued God like that, if you've never seen him as a treasure, as the most beautiful thing in this universe, as the only thing that could actually satisfy your soul, man, I hope that this stirs you up. Because he is. He is. But you're not going to find the pleasure that's in him until you can see him for who he is. I mean, I don't make it a habit of hanging around people that are critical and judgmental all the time because they bum me out. Right? I don't hang around people that are just going to sit around and judge me and judge other people because I'm like, that's just going to depress me. It's not going to make me happy. And if that's how you see God, you are not going to go to him for pleasure. Right? And here's the ultimate questions that you could ask yourself. When you're stressed out, what do you go to? When you're depressed, what do you go to? When you're bored, what do you go to? Right? The answers to those questions are more often than not going to point you to the broken cisterns that you're serving. I realize when I'm stressed out or when I'm angry or when whatever, I would go to things like video games or pornography or this or that or greed or lust or whatever else was in my life. I would constantly go to these things looking for something that I've never yet found in any of them. I didn't understand that God is the only one who has true joy and satisfaction within him. And he is. He does. Jeremiah 17, verse 5 through 8 says this, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. For he shall be like a shrub in the desert and shall not see good when it comes, but shall inhabit the parched places of the wilderness and a salt land which is not inhabited. But blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose hope is the Lord. For he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out its roots by the river, and will not fear when heat comes, but its leaf will be green and will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will it cease from yielding fruit ever." This is another passage that further illustrates the point that I've been trying to make to you guys. This is a passage that teaches us what true joy is actually all about. Right, we live in an incredibly envious culture, meaning that we live in a culture that is constantly wanting more than what we have. Everything in our culture is designed to make you unhappy with what you have. Right? Every commercial that you're watching, every ad that you see, every billboard that you drive past is designed, it's aimed, it's targeted at making you feel unsatisfied with what you have today and long for something that you could have tomorrow. And because of that, we're very, very envious. We're very lustful. We're always wanting and we're always seeking, but we're never finding. Right? And that's what envy is. It is the pursuit of pleasure outside of God. And it will never, ever be satisfied. Notice what he says, cursed is the man who does that. Cursed is the man who does that. Why? Because you're going to be like a shrub in the desert. Every now and then, yeah, you'll get satisfied. Yeah, it will fill you up and it will be great. But then those clouds will roll away and you're going to be left with nothing but you and your emptiness. That's why you're cursed. That's why you can't enjoy any of the things that you have. That's why you complain about everything that you have, is because you don't have joy. But notice what he says. He says, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord. Why? Because whose hope is the Lord, for he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out its roots. True joy and satisfaction, by the way, it's not gained by being shallow. We've gone over this a little bit before, but it's not gained by being shallow. It's gained by drawing your roots deep, deep into something. Because here is the definition of joy that this passage is giving us, and it's a very beautiful one. Joy is a peace, a satisfaction, and a contentment that is rooted in something greater than itself. That's what joy is. And the greater the source of your peace and satisfaction and contentment, the greater your happiness and pleasure will be. The reason why we're all the cursed man is because we've rooted ourselves in things that cannot satisfy us. And you have to ask yourself the question of, what are the things that I've rooted my happiness in? What are the things that make me feel like my life is worth living? Is it my looks? Am I constantly thinking about how other people view me? Am I a people pleaser? Am I someone who feels like nothing when people criticize me and I feel like everything when people praise me? Am I someone who's constantly being picky about the way that I look and the way that I dress and the way that I act and the way that I talk, and I'm being picky and complaining about all these things all the time? Well, then more than likely, what you have your pleasure rooted in is in vanity, your own looks. If you find all your pleasure and satisfaction in sexuality, I mean, you're constantly pursuing it, you're constantly going after it, whether it is in relationships or whether it's outside of relationships, and things like pornography and in novels and in chick flicks and things like that, always trying to find your value in romance and sexuality, well, then that is what your joy is ultimately rooted in. And is it money? Do you feel like your life would have meaning if you had a particular amount of money or if you had a particular job? Are you always striving for another promotion or more power over other people? Does it excite you and give you a lot of fantasies and dreams to think about having more authority and power? And does it frustrate you to no end when people do not listen to you and you feel unheard? Right? Possibly your God is greed. And I could go on and on and on. The truth is, and the fact is, that as much as we might say it in church that all I need is in God and all I have is in God, the truth is that is not true for any of us. We all have things that we have rooted our happiness in. And ultimately, the things that you think are making you happiest are the things that are keeping you the most empty. And God will work on those things in your life and in mine, constantly moving us and showing us that these things can never do for us what they claim, and only He can. He will pry our fingers off these things that we think are so important, and He'll show us that He is the only thing that is actually important. Psalm 73, the psalmist is frustrated. It's a great psalm. It's one of my favorites. The psalmist is so frustrated because he says, God, here I am and I'm serving you and I'm getting nothing out of it. Everybody around me is successful, but not me. They're rich, man. They're so rich that their eyes are bulging with increase. They got amazing relationships. They have wonderful times together. It's incredible. It's amazing. And he says, why have I washed my hands in vain? Right? I don't know if you've ever felt like that. He's like, I feel like I'm pursuing you, God. I'm getting nothing out of it. But then he says, but then I went into the temple of the Lord and I saw their end. You put their feet in slippery places, and behold, destruction will follow them. And then later on, he says this, behold, whom do I have in heaven but God? And upon this earth, there is none that I desire but him. My heart and my flesh may fail me, but you are the strength of my heart and my treasure forever. What's the psalmist trying to get at? He was frustrated and envious because he thought he defined success in a way that God doesn't define success. He defined value and joy and satisfaction and pleasure in ways that would never actually give it to him. And when he looked at people prospering around him and he was envious of them, he realized that he was being a fool because ultimately all their pleasure is just destroying them and leading them away from God, who is everything. That's why he says, man, there's nothing. There's nothing. I mean, listen to that line. Whom have I in heaven but you? Why do you want to go to heaven? Why do you want to go to heaven? Is it because it beats hell? That's why I wanted to go to heaven when I was a teenager. I was like, man, hell sounds terrible. I think I want heaven, you know? And so I was like, dude, I just don't want to go there. But I was a weirdo. I actually didn't want to go to heaven either. I was like, man, I just kind of want to die, you know? I told my parents that. I was like, can I just die? Because forever sounds like a long time. I don't know if I can handle that. And my parents were like, dude, it's okay. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know, can't God just take me? You know, can't you just end it? You know, and I could just cease to exist and my consciousness ends. And they're like, no, you gotta go to heaven. So I was like, okay, well, if I got to live forever, I don't want to go to hell. So, you know, I'm going to follow God and I won't go to hell. That was my whole motivation for going to heaven. But what does this psalmist say? Who do I have in heaven but you? Who do I have in heaven but you? If all there was in heaven was God, would you still want to go? Or are there things in heaven that you want more than God? Is perfect health and prosperity and the fact that you're going to be reunited with your family, is that why you want to go to heaven? Or is it because God is everything that you need and he's there? See, I never understood when I read the Bible why there's not much talk about heaven. I don't know if you guys have ever noticed that. There's only two chapters in the whole Bible about heaven. You go to any other religion, there's books on heaven, you know, like huge volumes on what heaven's going to be like, right? Christianity, two chapters. They're very vague, really symbolic, hard to read. You're like, why are they like that? Here's the simple answer. God wants heaven for us to be about him and not about a place. Because he is better than any other place. He's what makes heaven, heaven. He's what makes heaven, heaven. If you had everything that you ever wanted in the universe without God, that's hell. But if you just had God and you lost everything that means anything to you, that's heaven. He's better. He's greater than everything else. And the more we understand that, the deeper our roots will go. And the deeper our roots will go, the more our joy and pleasure sprouts out of it. The reason why our pleasure is so inconsistent is because we're so shallow. Right? We live in such an envious culture. That means we're always jumping from thing to thing and person to person and place to place and image to image and video to video, always looking for that which will satisfy us, but we never can find it. So all of our pleasure is very, very, almost embarrassingly shallow. What God is saying is, man, if you want true joy, you got to root yourself, man. You got to go deep into me. It's not like I'm bummed out and I'm like, oh, I'm going to read the Bible and I read a passage of the Bible. I'm like, whoa, you know, and it's like this super high, you know, like, you know, the same kind of high you get from actually doing drugs or getting drunk or viewing pornography. It's not going to be like that, right? It's going to be a relationship. And when you invest in a relationship, the pleasure is far greater, but the hard times you will have to go through. Right? If you were to ask any parent in this room, you would say, like, man, why should I have kids? Their answer would never be to be happy. Like, man, why should you have kids? Because if you have kids, you're just going to be happy. And all your problems are going to go away. And it's just going to be peace and prosperity for the rest of your life, man. It's going to be great. No troubles or trials whatsoever. They'd be like, dude, if that's where you're after, look somewhere else. You know, don't have kids, right, if that's what you're after. But I guarantee you, any parent in this room would say, yeah, it's hard, but it's worth it. It's better. It's better. And having kids is better than not having kids. I would never do anything to take away from the joy that I have with my children, even though they're a mess, right? Even though they have flaws, and even though they cause me, you know, gray hairs and hernias and all the rest that goes with it. But man, I would never give up anything if it meant having these kids. It's worth it. And that's what I'm saying about a relationship with God. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying that you could just go on cruise control and that the joy of God is so intense that you're never going to want anything else. Man, you're going to crave other things. I crave sin all the time. What I'm saying is that God is ultimately better than. And you take the best day in sin and you stack it up against the worst day with God, God is still superior. I never understood that as a teenager, but the more I understand that today, the more amazing my life is. And I forget. I forget all the time the pleasure of God, and I constantly find myself lusting after the things that I know deep down will never please me. And I have to remind myself daily, God is better. And I need to pursue him because he is. Next passage I want to read for you guys is Jeremiah 15, verse 18 through 21. Jeremiah says, "Why is my pain perpetual and my wound incurable, which refuses to be healed? Will you surely be to me an unreliable stream as waters that fail? Therefore, thus says the Lord, if you return, then I will bring you back. You will stand before me. If you take out the precious from the vial, you will be my mouth. Let them return to you, but you must not return to them. But I will make you this people, I will make you to this people a fortified bronze wall. They will fight against you, but they will never prevail. For I am with you to save you and deliver you, says the Lord. I will deliver you from the hand of the wicked, and I'll redeem you from the grip of the terrible." Jeremiah wrote this because all of his hometown had turned against him at this point, even to the point where his own family hired hitmen to try to kill him. And he's just like, man, God, this isn't working out, right? And he says, dude, my pain is perpetual. My wound is incurable. God, you failed me. You failed me. And God says, you need to return to me, but don't return to them. Meaning, what Jeremiah shows us here, which is so important, so important. This is the first place I learned to do this. When you pray to God, be honest. I didn't understand that. I didn't know how to pray honestly to God. I prayed in really hypocritical ways. I would say things to God that were just untrue. I would go before God and I would just say, God, you're so good, and life is awesome, and I'm so thankful for you, and I love you. Amen. When in reality, that very day, I'd been like, man, God, it's terrible. And my life is horrible, and I just want to die, and yeah, man, this sucks. And I was just thinking about everything that was wrong with my life. But then when I came into prayer time, I was like, God, you're great, you know. And I would come to church and be like, God, you're great. You're awesome. Then I'd leave church and I would go pursue other things. I was being inconsistent in my relationship with God because I didn't know how to be honest with him. Jeremiah taught me how to be honest with God. Notice how brazen he is. He's like, God, you failed me. You failed me. I mean, that's a radical thing to say to the God of the entire universe. A lot of people would tell you, man, you don't talk to God like that. He is too great and mighty to be talked to that way. Well, my argument is I think he's too great and mighty to not be talked to that way. You as parents will understand that, right? It's not a weakness as a parent to want to hear honesty from your children. It doesn't in any way defame your glory or your authority to hear honesty from your children. It in fact demonstrates your love towards them, doesn't it? If you were a parent who just said, hey, son, you know, I know you got issues, but keep them to yourself. I'm too great for that. I'm too great to hear your problems. You know, I'm your dad. I'm better than you, right? Keep them to yourself. Right? That's not a loving relationship. That's a dictator. Right? As a parent, you'd say, no, I love you. I want to hear what's going on, even if it hurts me. I want to hear it because I want to be there for you in honesty. That's how God is. He is too loving, he is too great, he is too mighty, he is too beautiful to not hear the truth from us. I learned through Jeremiah how to confess my emotions to God. I learned how to go before God and be honest with him. When I was depressed, I would say, God, I'm depressed right now. Can you help me out? When I was angry, I'd be like, God, I hate that person right now, right? I didn't say, God, you know, he's awesome and, you know, forgive him or whatever. You know, like I was like, God, that guy is terrible. I hope he dies, right? And I learned to be honest with the Lord. And it was amazing. I realized that when I was being honest with God, what I was actually doing, this is exactly what Jeremiah is doing, is he wasn't being arrogant. He wasn't telling God how it is. He was submitting his emotions to God and saying, God, this is how I feel. I know it's wrong. I know it's wrong, but this is how I feel. Can you help me? Right? So now I'm going before God and I'm saying stuff like that. I'm not like, God, this is how it is. That person's terrible. You need to strike them dead. I'm like, God, this is how I feel, but I know it's not appropriate. Help me not to feel this way. If you don't do that, all that's going to happen to your emotions is they're going to get repressed. You're going to deny them and ignore them, but it doesn't mean they've gone away. And what you refuse to see is secretly controlling all of your actions. Right? I was unable to be honest with God because I didn't understand that it's what God wants. In Psalm 139, the psalmist says, "Behold, you desire honesty in the innermost parts." Right? God wants us to be honest with him. He wants us to tell him the truth because guess what? He already knows it. He already knows it. You're not going to blow him away. You're not going to be like, God, I hate that guy. He's like, what? I thought you were perfect. You're my perfect child. You're not supposed to feel that way. This is terrible. It ruins my whole perception of you. You know, God's not going to say it. He already knows. God, I hate that guy. I know. Right? I know. Thanks for telling me. You know, and then he'll help you from there. And I love the way he responds to him. I love the way that he responds to him. He gives him hope. He's like, God, man, I'm there for you. Right now, the reason why you're so bummed out, Jeremiah, is because you have defined what is going to make you you based on how your family sees you. But your family's going to reject you. Why? Because they've rejected me. They've rejected me, and how could they possibly accept you? You're my prophet, man. You speak for me. They hate me, they're going to hate you. But aren't I better? Is my love greater than the love of your family? Or do you want to sell out what you have with me in order to have something false with them? Right? That's God's answer and response. He says, do you come to me? You come to me, you're going to have everything that you wanted, man. I'm going to make you a wall. Dude, no one's going to be able to take you down. It's going to be amazing. And God makes good on that promise. He makes Jeremiah a wonderful light. So when we look at Jeremiah's life, and like I said, it's ultimately a tragic story, but it's not an ultimately irredeemable one. To this day, the book of Jeremiah has impacted me more than any other book in the Bible. And it wouldn't have done that if Jeremiah didn't go through what he went through. This is 2,500 years after this book was written, and it's still impacting people all over the world. You could never look at Jeremiah in heaven and say, man, don't you know that you wasted your life? Don't you know you wasted your life? You could have been happy, man. You could have done things. You could have been influential. People could have loved you if you just gave them good sermons, right? You gave them sermons about giving up and not, you know, repenting and turning away from the stuff that they love. You know, you gave them bummed out sermons. If you were just more accessible, man, you would have been so much more successful. And Jeremiah was like, what are you talking about? All the success I have comes from pursuing my goal and treasure, and all of my goal and treasure are in God. Jesus says, where your heart is, there your treasure, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Right? What is the treasure that you and I are pursuing? One more thing I want to leave you guys with. This hit me very hard because when I came back from Afghanistan, I was in a really hopeless part of my life. I went over there. I thought I was doing something that I wasn't, and it just really bummed me out. I just saw how hopeless the situation was over there. I was just like, God, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing, man? Like, I went over there and I was bummed out because all the people, what they were doing to one another, and how horrible it was. And I was like, you know, who cares if we set up a democracy there? They still believe this Islamic faith that's ultimately damning all of them. Like, who cares? It doesn't matter. Right? I just felt so useless. And then I came back here and I was like, okay, well, at least I'm going back to the United States. We're a Christian nation. And I was like, oh, dang it. You know, it's just the same here. You know, we have more prosperity, but we're still going to hell. We're still going away from God. And I was just so depressed. And I was like, God, what is the point of anything? Jeremiah helped me understand. Jeremiah 9 verse 6 says, heaping oppression upon repression and deceit upon deceit, they refuse to know me, declares the Lord. The first thing I had to understand is it's not God's fault. It's not God's fault. I was praying and asking, I was like, God, why don't you just show yourself to them? Do you know that wouldn't have done anything? God has shown himself to people and didn't do anything. Right? Jeremiah could be like, God, why don't you just show yourself? God would be like, I did, you know, to your people, and they still blew it. You know, it doesn't mean anything. All we say is, if God would just show himself, it would change my life. Thousands of people saw God and it didn't change anything. Yeah, for sure, they believed in God's existence, but it doesn't mean they wanted to follow him. Right? If everybody in America believed in God's existence, it wouldn't mean that they would want to follow him. If everybody in America believed in the Bible, it wouldn't mean that they would want to read the Bible or be closer to God. Belief in the existence of God is not the issue. Belief in God as a person is the issue. It's about trusting him and about pursuing him. That's what it's all about. I was like, dude, I could show up, but it wouldn't do anything. If you ever complained about God, why aren't you doing more? God is doing everything he can and more. There was one pastor who prayed this way. It impacted me. I just read it this week, and it's just so cool. He says, God, I know that what you're doing is exactly what I would do in your position if I had your wisdom. I love that prayer, man, because all the time we're like, God, you're not doing it right. God's like, if you knew what I know, You'd be doing the exact same thing. But because you're foolish, you think I am. I complained about God because I was missing information about what was going on. I was missing a truth that would have ultimately solved everything for me. Jeremiah could have complained, but you know what? Again, Jeremiah's faithfulness led to the return of Israel. He didn't see the success of his ministry in his lifetime. But we just got done with the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah are the people that came back into the land as a result of Jeremiah's faithfulness and teaching. He never saw it, but it happened. And that's the beautiful thing. That's the beautiful thing. The reason why you and I are so frustrated with the world, and we're frustrated with our country, and we're frustrated with everyone around us, is because we don't see the big picture. We don't see it. We don't see what God is doing. God is doing everything and more to save this world. And we blame him for what's going on in our lives and what other people are doing. And God, why don't you just save that person? Why don't you just wake that person up? God's saying, look, they refuse to know me. They refuse. It's not that I'm not trying. It's that they don't want it. So what exactly are you asking God to do? Are you asking God to force people? Are you asking God to take away their free will and to make them be good? Because that defeats the entire purpose of this creation. God was so invested in us, so invested in this world, and so invested in our free will and our ability to choose him freely, that he died for it. He died for it. Jesus could have easily made us all just worship him. But instead of making us, he died for our disobedience, and now he asks us. It says in the book of Revelation, behold, I stand at the door and I knock. Isn't that amazing? Right? God is, he's God. Man, I expected to say, behold, I stand at the door, and if you don't open, I'm kicking it down. You know, like, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. You know, you're God. You know, I can't really stop you. He's like, no, I knock. He puts himself in the ultimate shameful position. The position where he could be refused. It's always awkward to be on the end where you're knocking, where you're asking, where you're proposing. That's awkward because the other person then has the power to say no. But our God, the most powerful God, I mean, he's so amazing. He creates the entire universe with just a thought. Everything and anything that we can see and love and hear and touch in this world comes from him and his power. There is nothing that he wants to do that isn't going to happen. And yet that God, that incredibly powerful God, puts himself in the awkward position of asking if he could come into your life. That is mind-blowing to me. Maybe I need to understand that God knows far better than me. Hey, at this point, I have no better idea of what's happening in this world than I did years ago. I still don't know what's happening in this world. But what I do know is that God is in control and he is faithful. And that's enough. That's what I need to have peace. I don't need to know where the world is going. I need to know who is in control of the world. Right? That's what ultimately gives us peace and freedom from our anxiety. So I encourage you guys to read Jeremiah in your own time. Scott's going to go through it. It's going to be amazing. But let me pray for you guys, and then we'll have another song of worship. Father, I thank you so much for the faithfulness of Jeremiah. All right, how difficult his ministry was and how unbelievably difficult and tough it was to preach your word in faithfulness for his whole life and to even be killed for it. And Lord, I pray that you would give us that same kind of boldness, that we would live our lives for you, totally sold out for you, no matter what it costs us, understanding that ultimately, God, you are better. You are better than the things that we turn to. You're better than the things that we run to, God, because you are the only thing that's going to satisfy the human soul. Help us to know that and to understand that, to pursue you with diligence, and to understand that we can be honest with you, God, in all of our prayers and all of our time with you, God. Thank you for who you are and what you've done. In your name.